Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. So, no surprises that the front pages are full of President-elect Connolly. The Sunday Independent has a quote, "Let's shape a new republic." Higgins hails Connolly's momentous day. Independent secures 63% of valid votes. Humphreys wins only Cavan, Monaghan and almost 13%. Percent spoiled votes and 46% turnout. The Irish Mail on Sunday, Connolly the game changer. Landslide victory for combined left candidate. Over 213,000 spoiled votes pile pressure on Martin is their read on it. The Sunday Times, Connolly celebrates, but election raises questions for the future is their headline. Independent TD wins in landslide, but record 13% of ballot papers are spoilt amidst unhappiness about lack of candidate choice and immigration, they say. The Sun on Sunday, Cath landslide as thousands ruin papers to the victor. And the spoils, very clever. And the Irish Sunday Mirror, West Wing. Galway's Catherine Connolly is 10th President of Ireland. And the Business Post have a poll, and their headline out of that is Coalition support falls again as Sinn Féin gains. Now, our panel this morning, Noel Rock is Director of Public Affairs at Red Flag and a former Fine Gael TD. Professor Niamh Horrigan is Vice President of Academic Affairs at Mary Immaculate College and a Labour Party European election candidate. Pat Leahy is Political Editor of the Irish Times and Alison O'Connor is a columnist with the Sunday Times. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
So, Niamh Horrigan, we start with you as a Catherine Connolly supporter. How are you feeling today?
Yeah, it's been a momentous weekend. And I suppose the question coming out of it, Brendan, really is it a game changer? Is it a potential game changer? Obviously,
we'll come to all those questions. Yeah, yeah. Let's have a moment first.
Let's have a moment for Catherine and her wonderful campaign. And it's interesting when I think she was asked in February, did she want to run for president? And she said she would if she could unite the left around her. And she pulled it off. And I think a lot of people didn't believe she would pull it off. And all the way along, there were significant milestones in the journey. There's no doubt that some of the breaks fell her way. But it's an exceptional moment and a moment for celebration on the left. There's no doubt about it.
Alison, I saw you on TV last night after the declaration. And you were won over. I think we all were by the mood of the occasion. Was gracious, warm.
Absolutely. And I think it's that funny thing that happens after an election where someone, you can almost see someone growing into the role. And certainly as she crossed through the castle grounds, the Dublin Castle, and went in, there was a great grace and dignity about Catherine Connolly and her family, her husband and her two sons around her and her members of her campaign team. And also just the atmosphere in there, all parties, you know, very gracious concession by Heather Humphreys, that you had the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste to there. And I think it set, after a fractious campaign, it set a very good tone for the presidency.
Yeah. And I think, as you mentioned, when you look at other countries.
Yeah, I mean, it's particularly at the moment. I mean, you look at what's happening in America being, but I mean, you even see in the UK, I think that's very important for our democracy. And even that phrase I heard Theresa Reid use yesterday, you know, loser's consent, that, you know, Simon Harris was also gracious in speaking about Catherine Connolly, as Micheál Martin was saying, Catherine is now our president. And I think that sets a very good tone. And especially even when you look at the extraordinary number of spoiled votes and how there are clearly an awful lot of people who went, obviously some people did it in error, but that number of people going to the polls to deliberately, and
some of them took, I think
of that means that what we saw was, it was more than symbolism last night. I think it is important that it's I suppose you could say it's I know there are many indications otherwise, but in a way it was showing that there is a centre to Irish politics, and even the fact that all those people from different political parties and the losers and the winners, from what we saw on the television last night, it wasn't there. You know, we're greeting each other. There was a conviviality. The campaign was over.
Yeah, Noel Rock as a Fine Gaeler. I have to say, I haven't seen Heather Humphreys that relaxed in weeks. But it was nice to see, wasn't it?
Very much so, yeah. Getting to the end of the campaign can always be a relief for any candidate, regardless of if you're on the winning side or the losing side, naturally. I thought her concession speech was very nice. I thought it set the tone. You know, they were short, succinct remarks, but they were clearly heartfelt. And Heather is a warm person.
And plenty Gaeilge. I'd say at the limits of her Gaeilge, but she made a point of showing willing.
Yeah, absolutely. And she rode in behind it. And indeed, Catherine's Gaeilge, obviously, as Martin Hayden has said throughout the campaign, is very nice Gaeilge as well, I would say. And I was at the limits of my understanding in listening to it, but it seemed like a lovely speech.
I thought part of the skill of it actually was that I was able to, I'd be mediocre, like I was able to get most of what she was saying and the sense of it and everything. Pat, last night, what did you think?
Yeah, I wasn't in Dublin Castle. I was chained to a desk in the Irish Times in Tower Street, but several of my colleagues were there and along with other reporters, I thought conveyed that sense that you've described there. I have to say, I did think when I saw Micheál Martin and Simon Harris standing on the stage
getting on their best behaviour,
I thought, what are they doing there, you know? But actually, I thought Simon Harris kind of captured an important sentiment when he talked about this is what we do after elections. We come together and we accept the result. And that really is priceless, that in a way, that the fact that we still have a political system that can operate in that fashion, because as others have said, that's not apparent everywhere. Now, I don't think you can ignore, and I know you'll want to come on to talk about this, the fact that more than half of voters stayed at home and unprecedented numbers of voters spoiled their votes. So while our democracy clearly has considerable strengths to it, it also faces significant challenges.
Oh, yeah. Don't you worry. We'll come to the problems for sure. let's talk a little bit about how it was won first, though. Alison, a piece that isn't in the paper today, but Jack Horgan-Jones has an excellent piece inside the Catherine Connolly campaign. And just give us some of the, because I don't think anyone heard this before now, and this is the detail of how they worked it all out.
Journalistically, this is what I was looking for this morning, and the papers have delivered in spades, and as well as Jack's really good piece, Claire Scott in the Sunday Times, Daniel Murray in the Business Post. And there is one line I'll just start with in Jack Horgan-Jones' piece, which is just marvellous, where it says that sort of as things were beginning to gear up during the summer, that candidate Catherine Connolly was advised not to stop rollerblading on the prom in Galway for fear of injury.
Now
that's not a line that you'd hear elsewhere. So just running through it, you basically had that last January, leader of the Labour Party, Vanna Batchick, writing to Sock Dems and the Greens. Then Cian O'Callaghan, the acting leader of the Sock Dems, calling a meeting, expanding it out to Sinn Féin and People Before Profit. That was kind of the genesis of the five parties. Meanwhile, you had the Connolly campaign that it's in the Irish Times piece, we're told that as far back as 2020, Catherine Connolly was being urged to run and was dismissing it. But in the last 18 months was coming around to that idea. And then a name that keeps coming up, that of Beavan O'Connor, Catherine's parliamentary assistant, and a woman called Kayla Varley, who were the actual linchpins of the campaign.
And like down to that, for the preparation for the debate, it was just Catherine Connolly and for the debates. It was Catherine Connolly and Beavan O'Connor on their own. Just did it.
And you can, I think that makes sense when you see Catherine as a performer. A lot of what we saw was based on the 2018 repeal campaign in terms of the groups, how they were set up on the ground, WhatsApp groups, door to door, a merch shop, the small donations you had up to.
And then all the parties, how they all dovetailed into it in their own
so
ways.
So you had mid October, you had 15,000 volunteers, you know, going around. So if you have you had each in Claire Scott's piece, she's talking about how a cross-party executive coordinated messaging and fieldwork, and you had a reputed, you had Paul Murphy from People Before Profit, Matt Carty from Sinn Féin, Cian O'Callaghan from the Sock Dems, and Jennifer Whitmore. And I was talking to Jennifer Whitmore Friday, and she was saying, like, it wasn't like they were ringing up of a morning and saying, we think Catherine should do this. You know, Catherine was very much her own candidate. But if they had a concern, that the campaign was quick to call them back, you know, to speak to them. And I mean, I'm sure, and there were times, as we know, during the campaign, with some of the more controversial issues, where certainly in Labour, definitely where lips were bitten. And here's something I didn't know that's in the Sunday Times piece. That one requirement of some of those in Labour and the Sock Dems was that the controversial former MEPs Claire Daly and Mick Mollis would not be involved in the campaign, even though they're seen as close Connolly allies. So, and there's also in the Business Post piece, you have
Matt, Sinn Féin as well.
Matt Carty is saying, because crucially, is the social media. And that was there was a woman called Claire McGowan from The Wheel. And I suppose if I could say briefly, you're looking at the social media game. It was incredible. It seemed so good and so natural. And I read somewhere today that actually Catherine Connolly, I have heard before her that she has said she doesn't like having her photo taken and that she doesn't like doing pieces to camera. Mm. And that's why they worked around with a lot of the stuff that the traditional, but that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, my God, will they have to accept that their social media really is like, it's the equivalent of dad dancing at a wedding.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? No,
that you've been in lots of campaigns here and abroad. Like, really, hearing all that, it was a stunningly successfully run campaign, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Like, I mean, let's reflect on a lot of what you've talked about there, Alison, in terms of getting five parties together, five leaders together, five groups of members essentially together, and managing to navigate that, first of all. And then second of all, managing to navigate the little storms and squalls in between as well, where you had, let's say, within Labour, Alan Kelly coming out and saying that he wasn't supporting the candidate, and Labour managed to move on beyond that, and indeed the five parties managed to move on beyond that. Brian Lennon, the Green Party, saying that he wasn't supporting it, and they managed to move on beyond that as well. So that is no small thing, and that takes a lot of coordination and in a way a lot of sacrifice of each of the party's individual identities in order to be able to row in behind a united candidate in such a holistic and cohesive way.
I think the point is made though that they were all aware that they all had a different audience and demographic, and they all brought their audience and demographic to it, so it was kind of almost a coalition situation.
Of course, it's easier keep people on the reservation when you're winning.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the things that she did successfully was generate momentum from an early stage. Let's not forget that when she launched her campaign back in the middle of July, she didn't have the five parties on. She had People Before Profit, she had the Social Democrats, and she had a few left-wing independents. And I think that was, whether by accident or design, that was a key strategic move to get in early and then run the clock down on the others. So Labour eventually came on, the Greens came on. When it became apparent, because there was a left-wing candidate in the field already, that their choice was either to sit it out or to get behind Connolly. And a version of that also happened with Sinn Féin. This interminable internal discussion that went on for months and months over the summer, much of which seems to have centred around whether Mary Lou MacDonald was going to run. Mm. And when Mary Lou MacDonald decided not to run, the party didn't have another viable candidate to put into the race, so had to come behind Connolly. So
and,
that sort
and
of thing.
And there's someone makes the point that when they came to her, or when they met, she very much wasn't there as a supplicant to them. It was like, you can support me if you want, I'm doing this anyway.
Yeah, but my point is, she was able to do that because she was coming from a position of strength and Sinn Féin wasn't. Now, she did start to talk about United Ireland at that stage, which was clearly some sort of a nod towards Sinn Féin, because that's not something she'd spoken much about previously. But I think that is overlooked. I remember one Social Democrats TD saying to me at the time, and he reminded me again this week, about it, that their plan was to get in first and be the candidate that people could either come behind at that stage or stay out of the race.
Okay.
McCarthy did mention yesterday how Catherine Connolly was fourth in the polls when they came on board.
Yeah, okay.
Niamh, you picked John Deasy has a piece in the Business Post. Now, not to take from the magnificence of this campaign,
yes,
but he said, his headline is "Landslide for Left, but don't mistake win for political revolution." He makes the point in it that any blows delivered to the government party candidates were largely self-inflicted as well. Like, they did get lucky too.
Well, I think there's a couple of things, Brendan. The first thing is that presidential elections, if we look at recent history in Ireland, are probably the elections where the left have their most significant success rate. So, and if we look at what the presidency is about, it's a second tier election, but it focuses on vision, on values, and those are all things that left wing politicians tend to do well. So in a sense, it was a very good election for that coalition to build around. The key question really is, can you actually translate that into some form of impact at a first tier election, like a general election? For me, that question comes down to, because voters in those elections will come from a literal show me the money perspective. Yeah. General elections focus very much
values
on economic,
very well, but
and economic platforms, and it'll be about whether that coalition, and notwithstanding agreements about PACs or whatever, whether they can build a shared economic vision, which I suppose in one sense continues to grow the economy, protects the jobs that there, creates new jobs, but then delivers, I suppose, a fairer redistribution of the benefit of that growth, which
yeah.
is really
and
where
can Labour agree with people before profit?
Exactly.
Or any kind
and
of that.
Yeah. But I suppose the positive thing about it is, Brendan, having had this achievement, there is time to work on that. If you look at the pre-budgets and alternative budgets on the left, there's a lot of consensus around what the problem is, where the disagreements or the differences emerge around what are the solutions to those problems. So there's time to figure that out.
Sinn Féin TD Claire Curran yesterday seemed to allude to shared pillars that they could possibly
yeah.
go to, which is possibly the thinking in Sinn Féin. Okay, so that moves us on to the future for the United Left now. Alison, the Business Post, Daniel Murray has a piece, and his headline is a quote from Holly Cairns, I think. "Catherine lit a spark, we will keep that flame burning." And Catherine Connolly did very much seem to be saying last night, look, I'm now president and I will raise my voice, but really it's down to you guys now to keep this movement and this momentum going.
Yes, I suppose you can also, she did, but she, and you know, and I think importantly she said that she would be a president for all, even people who didn't vote for her. But you can also read into it where she sort of talked that it was important to speak up. It'll be... Remember Brian Leddon said in his piece in the Irish Times during the campaign that it was almost impossible to imagine Catherine Connolly leaving her beliefs at the door of the Oris. And I suppose that is the big question now that we will have to see. We saw the tone that was set by Michael D. And how incredible, I was thinking earlier, that Galway West has produced mm-hmm. for basically 21 years, it'll be 21 years of Galway West TDs in the Oris. What tone she will strike in the presidency, that remains to be seen. But we have, for me, it's looking at all those people who did support her, all those people, and I think Holly Cairns in particular yesterday was very good at talking about this, as was Ivana Bacik, talking about how, and I suppose it was unusual for them, the win, the joy, the collective sense of it, that all these people who had come on board and how to harness that. But it means the government parties really now do, and they were making noises in this yesterday, but you know, all those people who are feeling completely disenchanted, who cannot buy houses, who yeah. are really frustrated at the infrastructure thing, which we saw that in the, you know, I think a lot of that in the spoiled votes, the reason for those were so, I know that some people will claim that for the fact that Maria Steen wasn't on, but I mean, there was a whole myriad of reasons. And you can't, as Niamh said, it's a second order election. It's probably 4 years until a general election. You cannot overstate it. But if the left ever had an opportunity, ever,
now is
it is now. And I suppose, in a way, the by-election in Galway will be very interesting to watch to see how they decide to approach it.
Noel, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times, Alison's piece actually in the Sunday Times, that
thanks,
Mary Lou MacDonald is the big winner after the Connolly victory.
Yeah, no, it's a good piece from Alison. Well done, Alison. in relation to Mary Lou MacDonald and I suppose the road ahead essentially from here and how Sinn Féin picked well, reviewed the situation, picked at the right time ultimately, and like Matt Carty said, managed to give a boost to the campaign. Not only a boost in terms of the polls, but a boost in terms of where the campaign was at that point in time, in that they had a well-developed urban infrastructure, okay, but not necessarily a rural infrastructure.
And to the future now?
To the future now, well, in 6 months' time, we have to have a by-election. Well, 6 months from November 11th, we have to have a by-election. So the question mark, I suppose, is what does the direction of travel look like there? Is it a United Left candidate, or is it a sort of Diet Coke version of that, which is a agreed transfer pact, which we've seen those in the past. They don't tend to work necessarily as well. And that will be revealing in and of itself, because if they can't necessarily agree even a transfer pact for a by-election, then what hope is there for a general election when there'll be 40 plus individual contests like that? So okay. I think that's Pat, it'll be an interesting insight into what's coming.
Okay, yeah. Pat, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times as well. Jennifer Bray, red comes in many shades. A careful blend is needed for change to happen. So is Sinn Féin going to be minded to share the spoils?
Well, I mean, I suppose this is...
You know what I mean? Like,
United
Left is all very well, but are Sinn Féin really going to, like, you know, bring a United Left along with them?
If they smell some kind of
a victory in some other way?
I think what Sinn Féin will probably do is they will seek to maximise this opportunity for their own benefit. So will all the other parties.
Yeah.
They're distinct parties with their own identities and their own agendas. But what the result yesterday does is it shows them that they can work together to achieve a common end. And in the far distance in the future is the next general election, which must happen before November of 2029. The goal will be to form a left government. I don't think there'll be agreed candidates in constituencies.
It's very risky in a PR system to run a single candidate.
Our system supports multiple candidates
with transfer packs.
But there will be a vote left, transfer left
movement,
I think, and that'll probably get a run out in the election. The worry in the smaller left parties, in Labour, in People Before Profit, in the Social Democrats, is that the gains that Sinn Féin might be eyeing could come at their expense. And that has always been the anxiety there. It's one of the reasons why there wasn't a formal pact before the last election. But I think, you know, that having been said, Jennifer Bray has a good piece, I think, in which she kind of concludes that this in itself isn't a game changer in terms of electoral politics. But what it does mean is that there is the potential for seismic change there in the future in a way that didn't seem apparent, say, before the last election.
Noel, you picked two pieces on the spoiled vote thing. Fionnuala Sheehan's piece in the Sunday Independent, Why Connolly Won and Why the Centre Cannot Hold, and the Sunday Times editorial, Sheer Volume of Spoiled Ballot Papers Must Be Wake-Up Call.
Yeah, so the Fionnuala Sheehan piece in particular opens in my constituency of Dublin North West and highlights, or my old constituency rather, and highlights that there are 21% of spoiled votes there. And actually, if you go down through the results, it's interesting where the spoiled votes tend to peak are in areas of generally urban deprivation.
So you have insight into your constituency. You ran there, you went door to door there. What do you think it says?
I think what it doesn't say is what people were claiming yesterday, which on many programmes, including on RT Radio 1, people were trying to ascribe it to being a groundswell of support for one candidate or one ideology. What I think it does say is that there is a severe disaffection within the system, and that disaffection runs along a number of stratas, to an extent around the economy, to an extent around recent measures in the budget, to an extent around migration as well. I mean, we can't ignore or avoid that. That literally did come out of the boxes and literally was written on the ballots. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be remiss, actually, if I didn't mention it in the list of reasons. But also, and finally, a disaffection about the choices on the ballot. There were simply only two choices on the ballot, and people don't tend to like to fall into a binary decision-making system.
But do you not think, Noel, that part of the... Like, if we look at 2011, we had 7 candidates. If we look at 2018, we had 6 candidates. Mm. Big difference in 2011 is that Enniskanny didn't whip the councillors. So you had a much greater diversity of people coming through from the council route. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of talk at the moment, and there was yesterday, about the lack of choice within the system. But the same system actually delivered a greater selection of candidates in 2011 and 2018.
And Niamh, more broadly, with your sociologist hat on, the spoiled vote, you picked a piece to have at the Monaghan Lynott in the Sunday Independent, calling it a spoiled vote quake, a strong message to the government. Is there a broader message of disillusionment and disenchantment with the political system coming from...
I think there probably is. I mean, to be fair, this is the first election that I can remember in Ireland where people who had been engaged with the campaign were actually calling for votes to be spoiled. I can't recollect. So, and actually saying to people, if you are disaffected, this is a way of having that disaffection count. As opposed to just not turning up at the polls. And I mean, it's important to remember the turnout yesterday was actually slightly up on 2018. And
yeah, but if you take into account the spoiled vote portion, it wasn't really, was
it? Yeah, but
it?
people turned up to spoil their vote.
Yeah. That's one of the things that boosted turnout.
And I suppose the question, I suppose where it becomes more problematic is that people who are saying, well, go and spoil your vote, tended, I think, particularly in the Maria Steen campaign, but we saw a much greater diversity of reasons for the spoiling in. And I suppose the other thing, and this is a question for Commissioner Tauchon, is that we saw a lot of people snap or take photographs of their and put it up on social media, which is not allowed. And I suppose that's something that they need to reflect on the process going forward.
Pat, what would you read into the spoiled vote and the conversation we need to have about it now?
I think it's important to realise, as Noel says, that there's a myriad of reasons. And even just watching the ballots tumble out of the boxes and looking at the pictures of the various spoiled ballots, it's very obvious that there's a bunch of schools of thought, if that's not too grandiose a term, behind the spoiling of votes. And that means that there isn't one simple answer as to what to do. What I would like to see is, I'd like to see the Electoral Commission actually studying those spoiled votes, or that being part of the electoral the national election study, to have a look at the patterns from it while we still have the ballot papers, to evaluate exactly what the messages were and to conduct some research on that.
Just before we go into the break, you did pick Maria Steen's piece in the Sunday Independent. Historic spoiled vote vindicates what I said about our political class.
Yeah, but even Maria Steen herself doesn't say that. In fact, she says explicitly that all those spoiled votes weren't as a result of people annoyed that she wasn't in the election. She can't interpret them as a mandate as a mandate for her. Though clearly a sizable number of them, and I suppose from wearing my political correspondence hat, we all agreed that it would have been a much livelier campaign had Maria Steen.
Well, also it totally backfired on the two parties, because if Maria Steen, for instance, had been in, the chances of Heather picking up transfers from her would have been significant, I think.
Okay, we'll take a break. Noel Rock, former Fine Gael TD, Niamh Horrigan, former Labour Party election candidate, Pat Leahy and Alison O'Connor staying with us. Welcome back, Noel Rock, Niamh Horrigan, Pat Leahy and Alison O'Connor still here. Former Fianna Fáil Government Minister Mary Hanafin, good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
Mary, we spoke to you back in June when you told us that you were going to seek the Fianna Fáil nomination. Then again, we talked to you at the end of August. You told us you were withdrawing. How are you feeling today?
Well, congratulations to Catherine, I have to say. Wonderful for her. If I just would say, there's a couple of things that I really admire about her. I think her resilience as a person coming from a background that can't have been easy. Her commitment to education, continuing to train to be a barrister, and an Grádh an Gaeilge. And I think those three things will be reflected in her as a person and as an inspiration for the country. And I really wish her well with it. I also enjoyed being a hurdler on the ditch for the last few weeks while the campaign was going on.
Oh, I'd say you did, yeah. I'd say you might have been thinking you were as well off out of that. Come here. So what's the feeling in the Fianna Fáil party this morning? Is there a lot of hurt and embarrassment out there?
Yeah, I believe there is. There are a couple of things that I think are needed. First of all, I wouldn't like to be trying to sell a raffle ticket in Fianna Fáil at the moment, because there's a couple of 100,000 gone west. And there were TDs who at the beginning of the summer were saying, oh, we're not going to spend the money on a campaign and we shouldn't waste it, etc. And that's exactly what we did do, spend and waste. So I think that'd be difficult. The second thing is, the best way to motivate a member of a political party is to have them involved in an election. And the elections are over. The general election, the local elections, the European election, the presidential election, they're all over. So you now have members all over the country who are wondering what is their role.
And the devil will make work for idle hands. Yeah. So what's the feeling about Micheál Martin's leadership of the party now? Now, I think there's two schools of thought here. Like, a lot of people saying, no, he'll make it until the transition at the end of 2027. If he makes it as far as July to the European Council, he's home and hosed. There are mutterings as well about that now could be the time for somebody to heave.
I think there's two distinct modes of thought, but where they break down is, there's Micheál Martin, the leader of Fianna Fáil, and there's Micheál Martin, the Taoiseach. And I don't think anybody in Fianna Fáil or outside wants Micheál Martin to give up the position of Taoiseach, one of them being that I don't want to see Simon Harris in the role. But I think he's a very good Taoiseach. He's highly respected. He's working very well on the international stage. And I believe, as do a lot of Fianna Fáil members, it's important that he carry through, particularly to the presidency of Europe. So that would bring him to the end of 2026. Now, beyond that, I don't see what his role is. And I think if you're going to prepare for the general election then coming up, what, a year or 15 months then after that, that's when the Fianna Fáil leader.
Yeah, they'll have plenty of time to hold on to the transition and then put in a new leader for the election. Listen, what has happened, the famous Fianna Fáil electoral machine? Like, this was amateur hour, wasn't it? And, you know, this is what Fianna Fáil were supposed to be good at all these years.
It was appalling, and I was listening to your panel there, and they hit the nail on the head, as a number of writers today. We didn't do either thing well. We didn't do the on-the-ground campaign, the preparation for it well, nor did we do anything like a social media campaign. And I think there was an arrogance on the part of the leadership in thinking that you could present a leader to the Irish people in September and say, please elect them in October. Successful campaigns like Catherine's, like Mary Robinson's before, and Mary McAleese was an exception, started back in February, March, going around, meeting people, going around to communities, attending events. That's the old-fashioned and the old style, and it still carries an awful lot of weight. Fianna Fáil didn't even do that this time. And even though there were young people who were assigned to Jim Gavin when he was in the campaign, they had no idea how to even do a social media campaign. And if Fianna Fáil does nothing for the next couple of years, it better learn how to do that. And I think, whereas we have a good
People have said they had a good social media game in other elections in recent years. But I heard your party colleague Billy Kelleher yesterday, and it sounded quite ominous. Like, he was basically saying that neither Fianna Fáil nor Fine Gael are able for this new environment and that they're not at the races compared to, he called the enthusiastic, positive, confident Connolly campaign run a different way in a new world.
Yeah, and Fianna Fáil haven't woken up to that new world yet. And there's no reason why they shouldn't have. I mean, I attended the OGRA conference and the OGRA dinner this year. Lots of bright, young, intelligent, well-educated people, hugely enthusiastic, who know how to do social media. But they obviously are not being listened to when it comes to campaigns like this. I mean, I know that a lot of attention has been given to Jim Gavin's white trousers, even worse, leaving the gate open, the drone. I mean, that's amateurish, not by Jim Gavin, but by the people who are managing his campaign. And that should not have happened. And whereas Fianna Fáil might have done well in some respects in the last general election, I believe that was individual candidates in individual constituencies. Whereas now we need to focus on...
Is Fianna Fáil more a bunch of sole traders now than the movement it once was, Mary?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that has damaged the party is the one person, one vote. Because being a member of a common, being a member of the Court of Dáil Counter, doesn't mean anything anymore in the organisation. You have your power, you can turn up to the convention every 4 or 5 years, you can walk away, you needn't do anything. Whereas before, you had a certain sense of, I suppose, status in the organisation by being an active member of your common and Court of Dáil, and that's gone.
Okay, former Fianna Fáil Government Minister Mary Hanafin, thank you very much for those terrific insights. Alison, Gary Murphy's headline sums up well there some of what Mary was saying. Result is a requiem for the old parties.
Indeed. And Gary, the last line of Gary's column, that the government, after less than a year in office, already feels rudderless, tired and out of touch. Listening to Mary there, she is rocking her schadenfreude. And why wouldn't she?
No, she isn't. She's making, I mean, more in sorrow than
is.
In anger.
No, no,
really
she is. But she
about,
is.
About where Fianna Fáil is at.
Indeed. But I mean, you also, and she most certainly ran through her bullet points, and they are all very relevant. But you take into it, of course, the fact that Mary herself wanted to run. I'm saying you can see why she's feeling as she did. And I doubt very much that Micheál Martin is having a particularly relaxed day to day. But no more than what Mary was saying there about the difference between him as leader of Fianna Fáil and as Taoiseach, speaking to one or two people yesterday about, you know, was there imminent danger? They were saying, look, we're not feeling it from Jim right at the moment, even though you could say there's an argument that the Taoiseach is damaged, Jack Chambers, the main competition, is damaged, Jim O'Callaghan is in a strong position in a department that can throw really tricky things at any time. Now, if you read, looking at the Mail on Sunday today, there's a wonderfully hyperbolic quote from James O'Connor, who's a known critic of Micheál Martin's, and he's saying, it's now up to other TDs and senators in the party if they want the court of Louis XIV to continue. And they're quoting a WhatsApp group that lit up where one TD said something has to change for the good of the country. So reading that, you know, you're feeling a sense of something imminent.
But Aoife needs a leader.
Aoife needs a leader. The one thing I will say is that we are going to get this report over the next couple of weeks on the selection of Jim Gavin and all of that. That could be a potential danger point.
OK, Pat, you picked that Irish Mail and Sunday piece. Martin's bad decisions hand the momentum to re-energise left.
Yeah, John Lee makes the point that in the lifespan of all leaders, there comes a point when it suddenly becomes apparent that their judgment is gone. Mm. And perhaps that's a function of
but
being
how
in
much,
power
Pat, do you think it was the Bertie Ahern factor in Micheál Martin getting it so wrong? You know, he just didn't seem to be able to land on a decision. And was it the kind of ghosts of Christmas past? They came in so late. It was unusual. Do you not think it could have been that they couldn't deal with the Bertie issue and that made him...
I don't think there was ever. I don't think that there was ever any reluctance on Micheál Martin's part to block Bertie Ahern. I think he was always going to do that. It was just a matter of how.
But he gave him a long time to talk about it, and they did come in late. And I think that's where it's very interesting to look at some of the parallels between the 1990 presidential election campaign and Charlie Haughey's position at that time. And even though he didn't go straight, it was the beginning of the end.
In hindsight, it was the beginning of the end. And
Pat,
do you think
when you say about the judgment thing, did that start? It started at the start of the year. People cribbing about Lowry, speaking rights, all of that. Is this a culmination of a lot of kind of nibbling at Micheál Martin's judgment?
I think that's what you do hear from people in Fianna Fáil. The prominence of Michael Lowry. Not so much the fact that you know, that a government was formed with independence. I don't think people have any difficulties with that. And, you know, if you go back to early on this year, there weren't other people offering. The parties of the left weren't offering to form a government with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And it was the obligation to form one with the support of whomsoever they could attract. But the prominence of Michael Lowry subsequently became a political problem, and it handed a stick to their opponents to beat them with. The bit... I find that understandable, even though
I think the speaking rights row did, certainly in terms of open up lines of communication between different parties
that
on the left.
That was the genesis of
it. It was also hugely overblown at the time. But I think the big evidence of questions about Micheál Martin's judgment was in the selection of Jim Gavin. Not so much in the difficulties that led to him withdrawing to the race. He wasn't flying as a candidate even before the controversy about his former tenant blew up. Yeah. And that was a gap in there.
Is Micheál Martin safe for now, in your opinion?
I think he is safe for now because I don't think the middle ground of the party sees a viable alternative. I don't think they think that dumping Micheál Martin is in their interest.
I think they don't think now is the time.
However, However, I think that his period as leader has probably been shortened by this.
Okay, Noel, the Sunday Independent, Conal Thomas, where did it all go wrong for Fine Gael's much-loved Heather? Where did it go wrong for Fine Gael?
Well, we didn't win. That'd be the start of it. I think there were a number of challenges in this election for Fine Gael. First of all, you had a situation where we had agreed a candidate, Mairead McGuinness. Mairead McGuinness unfortunately had to pull out of the contest due to illness. We had to put in a new candidate and a new structure and a new contest in place. That was one
challenge.
But there
wasn't a contest.
Well, there was the possibility of a contest. I mean, if enough people had endorsed Sean Kelly or another candidate, there would have been a contest. But the reality is not enough nominations were received for a second person, so therefore there wasn't a contest. But there was a mechanism put in place to open up the possibility of a contest.
Yeah, should have been a contest?
I mean, if enough people had nominated somebody else, of course there would have been a contest, and that could have been.
Should there have been one?
I think hindsight...
Would that not have helped people to see what Heather Humphreys' mettle as a candidate was like?
I think all candidates have their strengths and their weaknesses. I think Heather's strengths would have shown in a potential internal contest as well as her weaknesses possibly. So I wouldn't necessarily say
what that... What strengths did she show in this campaign?
I think she showed, and I think even in concession, she showed a warmth, genuineness, sincerity, humility, and I think
was that knocked out of her by the people who were managing this campaign. I think there was a feeling a lot of the time that she was almost presenting as being slightly hostage. Kind of, someone talked about fear in her eyes a lot, like that. Was Heather allowed to be Heather in this contest?
I think she was, certainly. I think she came across well in the contest. I think what had to happen in the final week, naturally, was there had to be defensiveness, if you like, around the campaign, given where the polling figures were going. And there also had to be questions asked, I suppose. And some of those questions were robust and challenging, and I accept that, obviously, watching it from the outside. But nevertheless, when you're in that situation, I think that's what you do.
Niamh, briefly, you want to go in there?
Yeah, I think the perception that the campaign went negative towards the end damaged Heather, and she didn't, to me, appear to be comfortable with that. You hear many people say, you know, when Heather Humphreys would go to things like the ploughing championships and stuff, she would eclipse ministers for agriculture. We didn't see that in the campaign. I think it's a question of, again, working with the person and the strengths they have, and perhaps the campaign strategically didn't manage to do that. Whether that would have changed the outcome or not is a different question, I think.
Alison, you wanted to mention the poll in the Business Post today, for what it's worth and how it's relevant to all of this.
Will I start with giving the top
yes,
line figures?
Please, yeah.
It's an online poll, a sample of just over 1,000 adults, and a margin of error plus or minus 3%. So what's interesting about this, and what's being pointed out by Daniel Murray, I suppose, is that collectively Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael since the election are down 7%. So you have, and I suppose that the two headline figures is Sinn Féin up 2 to 23, Fianna Fáil down 1 to 17, and that Fine Gael are on 19%. And then if you're looking at, we've been talking about the left-wing alliance, that for the Social Democrats, they've gone up 2 to 9. But he makes the point, I suppose most interesting in that is...
Just give us the other parties as well,
Labour 4%, ANPU 4, they're plus 1, the Greens 3, Static, People Before Profit, Solidarity 3%, minus 1. So you can see it's a mixed bag for those in the left alliance, and I suppose that even the gains are within the margin of error. But focusing in on the Sinn Féin recovery, Daniel Murray's pointing out there are two ways to look at that, that if you pick the party's lowest point of 17% a year ago, it's a good result today that they're up at 23%. But if you compare it to their high of 36% back in May 2022, that clearly is a lot lower and shows how much, you know, the work that's there. But I mean, I suppose you just cannot take from the fact that it's, you know, they're on a high today, as are the other four parties. As we were saying earlier, where does it go from there? And that the government parties have had a kicking, are on a low and are going to find it much more difficult to pick themselves up.
I thought it was remarkable how little change there was in that poll. That basically paints the picture of where the polls have been for the last 4 or 5 months. So while we're in the middle of this, you know, political earthquake when it comes to the presidential election. Actually, you ask people about their general election voting intentions, and they're not.
And that does reflect, doesn't it, though, how Irish people traditionally have voted differently in a presidential election. This is where you have to be very careful with what you read into it, to what they do.
Back to what you were saying, Niamh, a movement around values versus like...
Exactly. If the left were to seriously form a government, the parties that back Catherine Connolly, you'd need 90 seats to be safe. Yeah. They're on about 67. Yeah. So first of all, you have to stop pillaging each other. That's the first thing. Second thing is you need to bring in the new voters who we saw in the referendum, we did see come out for Catherine Connolly. And then you need to eat away at those in the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael who are leaning towards the centre and who feel locked out of housing, who are concerned about affordability. That's the way to do it. It's not rocket science. I think it can be done.
The future is probably generational for the United Left, the demographics are very much
in favour of the left at the moment, because younger people who are locked out of housing are a growing group, and those older people who have housing, who benefit from the current situation, are not.
Okay, we'll take a break.
Differential turnout as well. I mean, if you're a political party building for the next 50 years, you want young voters. But if you're a political party with an eye on the next election, you want older voters because they're more likely to turn out.
Okay, we'll take a break. Noel Rock, Niamh Horrigan, Pat Leahy and Alison O'Connor staying with us. Welcome back. Our very lively panel still here. Noel Rock, Niamh Horrigan, Pat Leahy and Alison O'Connor. Niamh Horrigan, there was another very, very big and important story playing out during the week while all this was going on, which was City West and the appalling riots outside the iPass Centre there. So there's a lot of pieces today. You were looking at the policing.
Yeah.
Which widely viewed as being a kind of a better than, say, the Dublin City riots.
So there's a couple of things, and I think we're on a journey with this, but I think it's very important to note where we are. So there's clearly, if we look at what happened with iPass this week, there was learnings from the Dublin riot. So we see a step up. We see a step up in the level of sophistication of policing. But I do think, and I mean, there's a number of pieces that talk about the coverage of the what happened on social media. I think we have significantly further to go. And what I mean by that, Brendan, is that I think, and you know, things happen, right? But we are still in the space where policing to this is still largely reactive. And what we need is a proactive strategy. We need a task force. When we do this in Ireland on policing, we're very good at it.
Now, are the police not saying they are now monitoring social media and see, and it was on social media, it seems, that this was fomented?
It needs to step up a level again. And the point is that it's not just about a question of sitting back and waiting for these things to happen, because with intelligence-led policing, you know, the same actors who are, and this is well documented across the papers today, have been engaged in a variety of other protests, a variety of other issues. So there is a group here that need to be the subject of very targeted, very specialised and very strategic policing. We further to go on that, and I think that is evident from the fallout. And you know, to be fair to the GRA this week, they came out and made a statement kind of saying the same thing, and I think that's where we need the leadership in An Garda Síochána to move to the next stage with this one.
Yeah, I suppose what we did see was something that we all admired in Britain at the time over there, the riots in, I forget where it was now off the top of my head, but that there were people up in court the next day, and we did see that this week, and the commissioner warning people, you will, this is not fun and games, you will
and
have
a swift
huge
criminal
impact
justice
on your future.
Response is effective.
It looks good, and it did, and things did seem to dampen down as the week went on. Listen, we'd finish up on President-elect Connolly today. Noel, you picked a piece by Liam Collins in the Sunday Independent, Meet the Connolly Clan.
Tell us a little bit about
her and her family.
It's a lovely piece by Liam Collins that just gives us a bit of background. And it's funny because I've been watching this contest, as we all have for the last month, and I actually haven't got to know a huge amount about Catherine and her family.
Because, as she said last night, her family are very private
people. Very private people, yeah. So that was actually the first time I saw them when I was walking to Dublin Castle. So Liam kind of gives a bit of colour to this today. And it's good, you know, insofar as she's not actually a natural football player, she says, but even the Keepy Uppies video going so viral. She now has people handing her footballs up and down the country, and she says she feels like a bit of a fraud.
She played her on the street in Chantilly, though.
Yeah, exactly. And then she's a rollerblader, as you mentioned earlier on, a keen swimmer, as I think we learned at the Count Centre yesterday when she mentioned that she'd still be going to Leisureland. She has a husband, Brian, who, pertinent to today, has done 4 Dublin City marathons in the past, 5 triathlons. She's one of 14 siblings. I mean, it's a phenomenally big family. So loads of interesting stories there. And sadly, she's known sadness in her time as well. She would have lost her mother when she was age 9. And her mother was only 43 years old. So there's a lot of light and shade in the piece. And it's an interesting backstory.
I very much feel she was forged in that, in tragedy as well as joy in
very
her
much
family.
So.
Pat, you picked another piece there, Mary Regan in the Sunday Independent, The Outsider Who Made Her Way In.
Yeah, I suppose this is, it does give a bit of personal background, all right, but it's more of a political piece and charts her political development. She was encouraged to run for the council in Galway by Michael D. Higgins and his wife, but would go on to break with Michael D. Higgins when she wanted to get on the general election ticket for the 2007 general election. She became an independent. She ran in 2011 and then was elected in 2016. She was very much part of that gang of left-wing independents. They formed a technical group. Some of them she was very much identified with, Mick Wallace and Claire Daly. And although she never resiled from her closeness to them or her alliance, her previous alliance with them over the course of the election, they didn't come out. They're very controversial figures in their own right now,
okay,
and they were invisible on the campaign trail. And she was asked.
Mick Wallace came home to vote, I believe. Alison, just before we go, there was a piece you wanted to mention in the Sunday Times by Fionnuala Cassidy, and people will know Fionnuala Cassidy as a woman who has tirelessly worked on behalf of the ever diminishing band of thalidomide survivors in this country, and indeed their even more diminishing band of mothers.
Absolutely, and any of us who know Fionnuala would say indefatigable is
yes,
the word.
And Fionnuala
is 64 today. Happy birthday, Fionnuala. She has a piece in the Sunday Times that is well worth your time, and she's saying that while the government can't undo the past, it can start listening. As we know, this group, who were never expected to survive until now, have so many different health issues and are trying to get the state to acknowledge this, to give financial support.
And I think they'd like an apology.
And to get an apology. And I mean, they're probably one of, they're the longest, it really is a mystery. Because purely from the point of view of politics, it's poor politics, it's bad publicity. Just on that alone, if you like.
There's an easy win for the establishment parties at the moment.
And I would, it's well worth having a read.
Okay. Thank you very much to my terrific panel this morning. Noel Rock, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Pat Leahy and Alison O'Connor.